Hi, I'm Alma Constance.
And I'm Lucinda.
And together in our Kids Law podcast, we've been looking at the laws that affect children as we grow up for 3 years now.
That's right. And to celebrate the third anniversary of this podcast, we're going to look back at our 5 most listened to episodes.
This is a great opportunity to celebrate what we've done so far, but also a nice overview of the podcast for those who are new here. I'd like to start with our 3rd most popular episode, which is the one that received the most publicity at the time, speaking with Sir Maxill KC, the Director of Public Prosecution. He was a very special guest for me, as I was keen to speak to him after I found out that 10 years old was the age of criminal responsibility in this country. That was quite a shock to me and prompted us to start this podcast series.
It was good to hear from Max that very few children commit crimes and even fewer of them as young as 10 are involved in crimes.
Why is it that 10 is the age of criminal responsibility in England and Wales? It seems very young.
Well, I agree that we all have a lot of growing up to do still, even when we reach the age of 10. But it's our Parliament who decide the age of criminal responsibility. And in this country, that has developed over a long period of time, many, many years. It is sometimes complicated how to deal with children who commit crime. And the age at which we even start to think about it, as I said, has changed over time. In Scotland, actually, they've changed the age of criminal responsibility. And that means that if you're 12 years or you're older than 12, you can be charged with a crime, but it's a little different and more complicated in terms of going to court. Now, there are other countries around Europe where the age is quite different. In places like Norway or Sweden, it's generally 15 years before you reach the age of criminal responsibility. But in America, in the United States of America, which is a very big country with lots of different states, they have different ages of criminal responsibility depending on which state you're in. In some of them, they're even younger than you, Alma Constance, even as low as 6 or 7 year olds, where people reach the age of criminal responsibility. So I completely understand that there are people here and around the world who want to talk about whether the age should be changed in their country, and that would include in this country. But it's a decision that can only be taken by Parliament, by the members of Parliament. The last time they talked about it was a couple of years ago in 2019, and it's really up to them if they want to talk about it again.
What happens to children under 10 if they commit a crime, and do their parents get involved?
Well, that's a very good question. There are children, as I said earlier, who, even when they're very young, do something that is wrong, that is naughty. But whatever it is, if you're under 10 years old, then we don't say that what you've done is commit a criminal offence. What will happen, though, is that for very young children, there are local authorities who look after the places where we live. And of course, there are police officers. And they can come and look together with the child's parents at why that child is getting into trouble. And what they will do is try and help the family to stop the child from getting into trouble again if you're under 10, if you keep on doing things that are seriously wrong. There are some things that the police can do or that local authorities can do. There's something called a local child curfew, and there's something else called a child safety order. So you can be supervised by the local authority or by the police. And the final thing that can happen where someone is under 10 years old, if you keep on doing things that are really, really badly wrong, is that the authorities think about whether the child should no longer live with their parents and should be taken into care, or whether something should happen to make the parents responsible for what the child has done. Because in every family, it's for mums and dads to look after children and make sure that they're all right, and make sure that nothing bad happens.
Number two in our list of most listened episodes, we welcomed one of the legends of the legal profession, Lady Brenda Hale, the first female president of the UK Supreme Court. In this episode, I wanted to know whether, as a child, I have any rights about the decisions in my life. Lady Hale agreed that it's important to take children seriously, to take our wishes and feelings into account. But when a child finds itself in court, it is the court's role to listen to the adult and also to the child. It was great to hear her remind us that adults care about our opinions and how they understand the world around them.
We all know that there are rules at home, at school, and in society, so it's important for us to know the rules apply to everyone. But if they are not good rules, we need to be able to look at them to see if we can make them better.
So how do children fit into all of this? Children can't vote for an MP.
No, they can't. You have to be 18 before you can vote. But we do now take children seriously as real people when they're involved in court cases. We have to take their views into account. We have to try and find out about their wishes and feelings in relation to a matter which concerns them. And so we've done a lot more to take children into account in court cases.
Can you explain how it works?
Well, if there is a court case about what should happen to a child, perhaps the mother and father can't live with one another anymore and they can't decide where the child should live, well, then a court would have to decide where the child should live. And the court will decide that according to what is best for the child, not what's best for the grown-ups, what's best for the child. And in deciding what's best for the child, the court has to find out how the child feels about things.
Does it mean that children have the right to tell the court what they want?
They do have the right to tell the court, usually through a welfare officer. That's a social worker who knows about children and how to talk with children. They do have the right to tell the court what they would like. But of course, they don't always get what they want.
What's the most important case you had about a child's life?
Well, I had lots and lots of important cases about children's lives, some of them very sad indeed. But there was a very interesting one about two children who were born in this country, grew up in this country, were going to schools in this country, but their mother came from another country and she had no right to be here. And so the government wanted to send her back to her own country. But if she went back to her own country, her children would have had to go too because there was nobody else to look after them. And that would mean that they lost all the things that they knew and were happy with here in this country. So we said the children's interests had to take priority, come first over the interests of anything else in that particular case. That was a very important case.
That sounds like a very sad situation. Have you ever had a child in court appear before you when you were a judge? What did you say to the child?
Yes, sometimes children, especially slightly older children, did ask to see me if I was deciding a case about their futures. And I did see the children. I would do that in my room, not in the courtroom. Somebody else would be there to take notes and make sure that, and I would take notes too, because I would have to say to the child, if you tell me anything that I think the grown-ups need to know, I'm going to have to tell the grown-ups. And so the child would have to understand that. The other thing I could tell the child was, I know what you want, and I know what your mother wants, and I know what your father wants, and I have to decide what's for the best. And one or other of your mother or father are not going to like that, but they'll have to put up with the answer. And even if you don't quite like the answer, you'll have to put up with it too. Do you understand that? So it was an opportunity for me to explain that children have to obey the rules too.
Sometimes I hear on the news about people arguing in courts, and it doesn't always seem that people are happy with the judges and their decisions. Why is that?
Well, as I've explained, judges have to hear all sides of the story, and usually there are two very different sides, people wanting very different things, and the judge has to make up his or her mind who is right. And of course that means that half of the people who go to court aren't very happy with the outcome. That's not surprising, is it?
Third up is our most downloaded episode, in which we talked to the former Lord Chief Justice, Lord Burnett, discussing why we need to have courts and judges and how they treat children if they need to go to court. In this episode, we learnt that there are many different types of judges, and they usually wear suits, not wigs and robes. Magistrate courts deal with about 90% of the criminal cases, and the magistrates are ordinary people rather than trained lawyers.
It was interesting to hear that the Lord Chief continued to sit as a judge most weeks, and Lord Burnett thought this was a very important part of his role.
How do courts make their decisions, and how can they tell if someone is telling the truth?
Well, it's absolutely vital that any judge listens to the argument from both sides and listens to the events that are in question. That's called evidence. And all it means is that somebody will explain what happened. Sometimes also produce documents, letters, and statements. And then the judge has to decide who's right and who's wrong. And that's how the system works. It can involve having to decide who's telling the truth and who isn't. It's more usual for everybody to be explaining what they think happened without necessarily making anything up, but often being wrong. So a judge has to listen to it all and look at it carefully. Sometimes, unfortunately, people do come along to courts and just tell lies. And usually, by looking carefully at everything that we've heard and looking at the documents, it's possible to be pretty clear who's telling lies and who isn't.
What powers do courts have when deciding the outcome of a case?
A court has different powers when it deals with different types of cases. If it's decided that someone has committed a crime, then the court has to punish them. And Parliament sets the punishments that are available for different crimes, and then the judges make a decision looking at guidelines for the judges and also how similar cases have been dealt with in the past. In family courts, the judges have to decide what should happen with disputes about children or about money, and they make an order, and then that is what people have to do. The same is true in the courts that decide arguments about money. At the end of the case, somebody will win, somebody won't win, and then the judge decides how much the loser has to pay to the winner.
If a person doesn't like the court's decision, what can they do?
Well, in any type of case, there is always a procedure which allows the person who didn't win to appeal to a higher court. And that can happen only if there is a serious argument that the judge has got it wrong. But that is a protection that ensures there's a higher court that can put it right.
As you are the head of the judiciary and the president of the Courts of England and Wales, how do you manage the judges and courts?
It's a fairly big job. I've just over 400 separate responsibilities that have been laid down by Parliament. It's a good thing that I can ask some people to do some of them for me. But there are some really important functions that I have responsibility for, which include the welfare and the education of all the judges. And keeping the courts operating well takes a great deal of time and energy. And I'm assisted by many other judges at different levels. I've also got about 250 civil servants in the judicial office who help us manage the judiciary. And then the courts themselves are run by a dedicated service, the Courts and Tribunals Service, and they deal with all the day-to-day practical arrangements for running the courts.
Our next most listened episode tackled a very complicated question. What is a constitution? Adam Wagner, a barrister, was our guest. He is also the only guest we've featured twice. Adam told us that most countries have a constitution, which regulates the way that the government, the lawmakers, and the judges work together. In the UK, We don't have a single document with all these rules, and so it's rather like a treasure hunt when looking for them.
Adam said it's important when laws are made to balance the rights of the individual and the government, and that we should have more people involved in looking at the proposed laws.
So for most people, the constitutions are invisible, but they're really, really important in how a state works. So if you think of it as if you go to school and the school has lots and lots of rules, ranging from, you know, what time the school opens and what time it shuts, whether you can run down the corridor or you have to walk, the way you behave towards people. The most important thing is making sure that all the systems the school uses, like how the head teacher behaves, what the rules the teachers have to follow, is central to how the whole institution runs. So in the same way a constitution decides what the relationship is between citizens and the governments, or like in our country, we have a king, it's really important in generating trust and coordination. And it's a framework for decisions being made by government, and particularly what's called the legislature, which is the lawmaking body. So every country has a group of people who make the laws. So in our country, we have a parliament, and we also have a government, which is the people who come from the political party that's in power and involves the prime minister and the ministers. And we also have judges who decide how the law should be interpreted and applied to individuals. And what's really important is within all those groups, one group shouldn't have too much power. So just like in a school, if you have a head teacher who is able to do exactly what they want, whenever they want, without any rules regulating them, or if even worse, if you have rules but no one can enforce them, then things tend to go wrong. So constitutions explain how all those different groups interact, and also how power is spread through the state.
What type of constitution do we have here in the United Kingdom?
So most countries have the rules of their constitution written down. The UK is different because, unlike many, many countries, it doesn't have a constitution which is written down in one place. If you want to find it, you've got to look for lots of different documents. And not all of the documents are obviously part of the constitution. You have to sort of ask somebody who's an expert to point you to the bits that they think is part of the constitution. And that can be in the statutes that come out of Parliament, in the decisions which judges make. It can be conventions, rule books. It can be a bit all over the place. You have to go on a bit of a treasure hunt to find the constitution. The point is, it's not very clear. But one of the central things about the UK constitution, which everybody would probably agree with, is that Parliament is at the centre of it. And that's what's sometimes called parliamentary sovereignty. And sovereign really means a king or a queen. But in our country, Parliament is at the centre of it, because Parliament can make and get rid of laws.
Do you think it does protect the rights of individuals? And can people challenge the decisions made by the government?
So that's a really big question and a really important one. So in theory, yes, there are laws to protect individuals from the state using power in the wrong way. But they're not always put into practice by the people whose job it is to put them into practice. And they may not treat people fairly and equally. If you have to go to the courts to enforce your rights, that can be really expensive. And although anybody can go to court, not everybody can afford a lawyer to argue their case in court. And it's really, really difficult to make your own arguments in court without a lawyer, because laws are really complicated and you need expertise to be able to do really well in court, usually.
Our fifth most popular episode, we talked about why some groups of people don't access human rights equally.
Yes, we discussed with Sultana Tafada Casey, together with her 11-year-old daughter, Safia, why girls need special protection and how law can be used to achieve equality through education, advocacy and litigation.
Sultana and Safia also spoke about why they set up the Girls Human Rights Hub and what their hopes were for the future and their initiative.
So we do sadly get lots of children who find themselves caught up in the criminal justice system. And I do represent young people who find themselves in that difficult situation. So unfortunately, children do get accused and convicted of being involved in very serious offences, such as murder and terrorism. And so throughout the trial process, what I try and do is ensure that they're heard, that they have a voice, and that the vulnerabilities that they have are brought to light. So you can get situations, for example, where young people are sometimes groomed into committing offences. There's something called county lines, where people actually get young people involved in selling drugs for them. And that can then escalate and end up in an even more serious situation involving serious violence. And so we try and raise the particular vulnerabilities of young people within the criminal justice system. So you do get a lot of people who are groomed online. And I do a lot of terrorism-related work, and you do get lots of people who are drawn in, who are groomed or radicalized online. There's also neurodiversity issues, sometimes with young people who find themselves in difficult situations. And these are issues that need to be raised in court, so the judge, the jury, everyone can understand why it is they behave or why they've behaved in a particular way. And so there are lots and lots of issues that crop up when it comes to young people that really need to be addressed in court.
I know that you are very passionate about equality and that you have recently founded the Girls Human Rights Hub in 2023. Why do girls need special protection in this area? And was there a particular event or thing that happened that led you to establish the Girls Human Rights Hub?
Good question. So girls do need particular protection when it comes to human rights. When you look at human rights, usually the conversation around human rights is usually women's rights. And girls become a subset of that. They're a part of that discussion. But there's never really a focus just on girls and girls' human rights. And actually, if you look at the human rights situation in different countries in the world, you'll find it's actually girls who suffer the most when it comes to their rights. You only have to look at the situation in Afghanistan, for example, and see that girls don't actually have the right to education. If you look at things like climate change and climate justice, it's something that affects everybody, but actually it affects girls the most. Every time there's a humanitarian disaster, there are always difficulties that girls in particular experience. So like recently, there was the earthquake in Morocco, and there were reports coming out that girls were really struggling. And this is really hard to sort of grapple with. Unfortunately, traffickers are always present in those types of situations. So girls are more vulnerable to being trafficked. There were reports coming out at the time that young girls were being forced into child marriages. They may have become orphaned, or their parents just didn't have the finances to look after them. And so people were coming in saying, we will marry this young child. And those are just some of the issues that girls face. And if you look around the world, even things like menstrual equity, girls don't have access to menstrual products. Whether you're looking at the UK, there are lots and lots of statistics that show that girls actually end up missing school because they don't actually have menstrual products and they feel embarrassed going to school. If you look at other parts of the world, they don't have access again, and they can end up using things like rags and get infected and so forth when it just comes to something as simple as menstruation. And so there are so many areas where girls are affected in particular. And it's really important not to put girls into this big category of women's rights, but actually focus in on girls' rights. And that was one of the reasons why we set up Girls Human Rights Hub. Now, Safia, who is my co-founder, my inspiration for setting up Girls Human Rights Hub, and it really came about through a discussion we were having.
In our podcast, we've been exploring how laws work and affect young people. All of these things help children understand their rights and responsibilities so they can make informed decisions, not only about their lives, but also about voting for MPs who make the laws, and so they can understand how the legal justice system works. It's also important that children know they should be kept safe and that adults must care for them. Remember, if you have any worries, talk to an adult you trust and tell them how you feel. This includes your teachers at school, who are there to look after you too.
Keep your questions coming in. Please subscribe, rate, and share the podcast with your friends. See you soon in the next episode.
Bye.